You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Cesena.
Cozze cittene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze cittene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Where are we, Lionel? Today we're in Cesena, Richard. Is that right, Daniel? Sorry.
Yes.
Cesena.
Yes.
Yeah. So insecure pronunciation.
Have I made you nervous? I can't believe that.
How can you not know where we are, Lionel? How can you not know?
I don't pay attention to, and you know, as long as there's a restaurant, I'm happy. It doesn't matter where I am. But we're in Cesena.
Talking of restaurants, sorry, before I forget, we're starting in a beautiful town called Trevi, as in the Trevi Fountains in Rome. And one of my favourite restaurants in Italy is in Trevi. It's called La Prepositura. If anyone ever finds themselves there.
Well, there you go. There's a top tip.
We are in Emilia Romagna this afternoon, but we would have come across the corner of Tuscany, or a good chunk of Tuscany, on stage 11 of the Giro, our Giro.
Started in Umbria, went skirted Assisi, dodging the Carabinieri, hopefully. As discussed yesterday, I think Lionel and I had a bit of a brush with the old bill there a couple of years ago, but hopefully they haven't caught up with us. And as you say, we've made a short incursion into Tuscany, the only one of our Giro, and then gone into the hills, the mountains of Emilia-Romagna, the Apennine Mountains, and we've gone over Monte Fumaiolo, which was a very famous climb, one of Marco Pantani's favourite training climbs, and then over another one, a little kicker before the finish, the Monte Vecchio, another one of Pantani's favourite haunts.
My old training road sees Daniel from...
Really?
I spent a couple of winters in Perugia, and used to ride around up to Arezzo.
You get as far as Cesena, I'm sure.
No, but up to Arezzo and round there, around the Lago Trasimeno. That was a nice ride. don't yeah. smirk, yeah. don't scoff. It's absolutely true. and now you as well, Lionel. It's a pincer movement here.
How come you didn't absorb more of the sort of local flavour?
I did. I just wear my knowledge very, very lightly.
It barely left a fingerprint on you.
Oh, that's harsh. Just a quick question. You use the British slang phrase "old bill" for the police. Every country's got their nickname for the cops, haven't they? What do the Italians affectionately call? He doesn't know.
Sbirri. Sbirri.
Okay. It's not as kind of romantic as the feds or the old bill or the flicks, is it? Quite,
but the flicks. You like that, do you?
Yeah, why not? I mean, that's the French, isn't it? Les flicks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, sbirri actually. I mean, it really means the sort of pigs. But yeah, it's often used to refer to the police.
What's coming up in today's episode, chaps?
Well, we are celebrating and interviewing Max Chiandri, who is, well, as I said in yesterday's little teaser, the man of Derby, Bournemouth, I didn't know that, Tuscany and Los Angeles, the sports director now for Movistar, the mastermind behind Richard Carapaz's overall victory at the Giro last year, the self-styled ninth man, wasn't he? You know, Movistar's run without Grand Tour success was coincided. Magic Max, maybe that's the episode title there. But yeah, coincided with Max Chiandri joining the team. He'd previously been at BMC. He's been at the British Cycling Academy for a while, and of course was a rider both for Italy and Great Britain. And we'll, over the course of today and tomorrow, we'll find out a lot more about Max Chiandri, including stuff that I didn't know, and things that I'd forgotten from, you know, long ago. Because when I first started covering cycling, Max Chiandri was quite a big figure in British cycling, because they were not the heady days, really, were they? The mid-90s, mid to late 90s, as Chris Boardman was really the only rider from Great Britain who was operating at the top level. Max Chiandri became British in time for the Olympics in Atlanta in 1996. We'll hear all about that over the course of today and tomorrow. So, yeah, just a familiar voice, isn't he, Max, from our Giro coverage. He's one of our go-to sports directors, really. He's always got something to say, something entertaining to say about every subject. And so we thought, well, he was on my list of people to sit down for lunch with at some point. But the lockdown has meant we can't do it face to face. So I called him in Tuscany, paradise, as he calls it. And we chatted for an hour or so. And we'll play a big chunk of it over the next couple of days.
Well, we'll play a little bit of it because the full interview will be for friends of the podcast. If you want to hear the full Max, the Max Max.
And you say
it'll be on the Friends feed, along with the Richie Port, the full Richie Port interview as well from a day or so ago.
And you say, Napon, we enjoy speaking to Max a lot of the Giro, and he's got a very nice voice to listen to, hasn't he? A lovely mellifluous sort of very kind of laid back, typically Tuscan. The Tuscans in Italy, I mean, the purest Italian is always supposedly spoken in Tuscany, but the accent itself, it always kind of sounds as though they're about to sneeze. They don't pronounce their C's and their G's. Ha, hey, io sono Toscano, or like that, and it's kind of how Max talks English. It's kind of how he speaks English as well.
I think that's how they speak Italian in Derby, to be fair. Anyway, stage 11 of our Giro on the RGT platform, something a little bit different today. We are assured by race director Daniele Fribrancini that the transitional stages will be a little bit easier today and tomorrow.
Well, there was a shadowy backstory to this, wasn't there? There were emergency talks.
We forced you to make it easier. We forced you to make it easier because it was starting to feel really quite hard. And as I've said, I'm only targeting the Inter-Giro competition. More about that a little bit later on. But today's stage of our Giro on the RGT platform, I'll be riding at 7:30 this evening. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, the day of release, 7:30 UK time, I will be on the start line. The stage is 24.7 kilometres long, only 447 metres of climbing, bit of a hill in the middle, but nice downhill and flat to the finish line. I'm hoping to be able to knock this stage off in around about an hour, so that will give you an idea of where, well, you'll probably know that most people will be better than me at cycling, so if I can do it, you can join us on the start line 7:30 this evening. See you there.
I was reminded today, Lionel, that Pantani showed up for the 2000 Giro sporting a bit of a goatee. So there'll be shades of Pantani, echoes of Pantani when you fly over that Monte Vecchio climb on the stage today, won't there?
I might dig out some form of bandana or, I don't know, bit of old tablecloth, tie it around my head.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
My name is James Turner. I am the IT manager at iWalker. Super passionate about everything to do with bicycles. Been sort of following the industry and racing and taking part in racing for as long as I can remember, and it's something that helps me keep very much sane and occupied in my downtime. I love the fact that iWalker does get involved in not just sort of straight business activities, and iWalker as a company, we see ourselves very much as an enabler for other small businesses. And so I do see the sort of the sporting angle of things being an enabler to society, if you will, as very much more a sort of just an extension on that and on that mission, if you will. We do have on staff quite a few talented athletes from many different sports, but personally, sort of being very involved in cycling myself, selfishly I really enjoyed that sort of announcement. It was great for me to hear out of the blue from my friends in the marketing department that they were thinking of getting involved initially with cycling, and then seeing the additional activities that have come out of the department has been it's just fantastic.
Amarcord. I remember.
What you want me to pull over just in?
Yeah, just here, just this village here.
What?
That we're coming into.
Park next to that square over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Dove siamo, Daniel?
We're in, Lionel, now that you mention it, a place called Seramazzoni, which no one has talked about, the fact that it's on the Giro route this year. No one will probably mention it today. However, about 8 or 9 years ago, I came here to interview a certain Riccardo Ricco, the infamous, the outlaw of the Giro. And I'm kind of curious to see, well, I don't think he lives here anymore, or he's spending most of his time in Tenerife, but I'm very curious to see if anyone remembers him, how much they know about what he's doing now, and what kind of legacy the Cobra, as the self-styled Cobra, that was his nickname, wasn't it, has left in little Seramazzoni up in the Apennines in Emilia-Romagna.
Extraordinary. I mean, loads of people out here this afternoon. Lots of pink banners and balloons that we've seen all along the route.
But no rubber snakes. We haven't seen any cobras, have we?
No cobras. You just wonder what the atmosphere would be like here if Rico was still racing and wasn't sort of exiled from cycling, exiled from the Giro and basically retired in disgrace. Banned for 12 years.
Well, I'll tell you what, should we get out of the car, have a look around, see if we can track someone down who knows where the Cobra is hiding?
No, prenderemo un bicchiere, no, due bicchieri d'acqua e due caffè.
Allora,
il caffè, sì. Ah, non sbravo. Grazie. Neanche voi non conoscete Riccardo Ricco? Adesso è stato cancellato dal Giro, cioè nessuno ne vuole più sapere.
Cancellato da tutto, bro.
Yeah, we used to see him a bit around here. He was an idiot. The house is empty, up for sale. Here, the general opinion is that he was just a donkey, a complete ass. Which is maybe what he is.
You gonna give it a go? Give him a ring?
Let's try.
Hang on,
no harm.
It says there, Cobra Ricco.
Be quiet, Lionel, you might answer. His phone's either off or he can't be reached at this moment. He could be in that restaurant after. I think he's skulking around at the back of the fridges somewhere. Maybe we should go and have another look.
Either that or he's out training.
Well, that was the regular feature, Amarcord. Remind us, Daniel, what Amarcord means.
Well, it's very appropriate you should ask, Rich, today of all days, because we're near the birthplace of Federico Fellini, probably the most famous Italian film director of all time. And Amarcord was one of his films made in the 1970s, sort of deals with and talks a lot about nostalgia. Well, it talks about the period of fascism in Italy and Fellini's sort of recollections of that period. So It's the name, the appellation that we've chosen for our little nostalgia trip every day, isn't it?
And today's was stalking Riccardo Ricco.
It was. We, Napalm and I, went high up into the hills, just slightly west of where we are today. So in the hills above Modena, on the trail of Riccardo Ricco. Remember him? The donkey.
How could we forget?
The donkey.
How could we forget?
Where is he now? Well, at last check, and this was fairly recent, I've got no reason to believe he's not doing this anymore. He was in Tenerife. He has emigrated to Tenerife, and he's opened an ice cream parlour.
His doping ban must be about to end.
Do you know what? I looked that up. I looked that up recently because I had a notion that it was 2020, but it's actually 2024, if I'm not mistaken.
We should have racing again by then.
He'll be racing you boys on our Giro 2024.
Actually, where do we stand on that if Rico pitches up? Is he allowed to take part in our Giro?
As long as he puts his weight in accurately and hasn't been eating a load of ice cream, or rather has been eating a load of ice cream.
Somebody go and check his fridge, not for ice cream.
I mean, he was extraordinary in that 2008 Giro, wasn't he? When he won he was second overall. He won the white jersey. Alberto Contador won the race and that was the year Contador had kind of come off the beach. But the kind of the most explosive rider of the race was Ricardo Rico, and then at the Tour de France he was equally explosive, and then, well, it all blew up in his face, didn't it, because he got arrested and tested positive for the second or third or fourth generation EPO type drug called Sira, along with Leonardo Piepoli of the Saunier Duval team. Quite a boom and bust for Rico, well, wasn't it?
And he came back, didn't he, and then was disgraced again a couple of years later when there was a story about some kind of dodgy blood bag that had been gone off at the back of his fridge, you know, in between the parmesan and the margarine. Or he probably didn't have margarine. I imagine you've got margarine in your fridge, haven't you, Napalm? But
absolutely not. What, stalk margarine? No offense to anyone who likes stalk margarine, but no.
I mean, Rico's dodgy blood in his fridge takes us nicely into our wine of the day feature, doesn't it?
Vino del giorno. Chin chin.
The cycling podcast Full Giro now makes its way to Tuscany. So we've got the Cosimo from Cosimo Maria Mazzini 2016. This particular wine is 90% Sangiovese and 10% Field Blend. Now the Field Blend comprises of six indigenous varieties from Tuscany that are all co-fermented with the Sangiovese, then fermented in large oak barrels for 12 months. All the fruit from Cosimo Maria Mazzini is farmed biodynamically, hand-harvested and crafted by my good friend Francesco. Now, Francesco only makes a sum total of 14,000 bottles, which sadly meant we ran out and had to switch to the Padera Brizio Rosso di Montalcino, also another fine exponent of Tuscan wine. This particular wine is 100% Sangiovese, also from biodynamic vineyards, that's then been barrel-aged for 12 months and then allowed to settle in bottle. Now, this particular wine, like the Cosimo, really appropriate for sort of stronger cheeses, darker meats, grilled meats, and stews and casseroles. Both fantastic exponents of Tuscany. I hope you enjoy.
Cheers, Rich.
Mm.
I see you haven't updated your stemware.
Still in the same glass. Well, not. I mean, I clean the glass, but it's the same glass I use for my wine. This is my Arogiro wine glass, Daniel.
So, Rich, today, well, I said we were going to Tuscany. It was a pretty gratuitous incursion into Tuscany, mainly for the purposes of our wine of the day, because the three great regions of Italian cycling are the Veneto, Lombardy, and Tuscany. The three great regions of Italian wine are Tuscany, Piedmont, mainly Piedmont, and the Veneto. But our Giro, the way it was shaping up, we weren't probably going to get into Tuscany, so I had to do a bit of manoeuvring to get us there. And today's wine is a Tuscan, not only a Tuscan wine, but a super Tuscan wine.
Well, it's great. I mean, it's lovely. It's a spectacular wine. We'll have a little tribute to the wine actually at the end from Francois Tomaso.
Any tasting notes? Bit of sort of potpourri there. Napalm, do you have potpourri as well as margarine in your house?
Well, I'm not sampling the wine at the moment, as I have an errand to run. I've got to drive a little bit later on, so I will look forward to my Tuscan wine with dinner this evening.
Well, there's licorice on the nose, Daniel, and well integrated tannins, I would say.
Lovely reading from Vivino.
You're
reading it from somewhere else.
Well, no, I didn't. I spoke to somebody about it actually.
Oh, really?
Done some research.
Lovely. It's a Sangiovese. Sangiovese is the big grape from Tuscany, also from Emilia Romagna. And do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to regurgitate. This is the most read passage ever in the cycling podcast. I must have read it out about five times by now. But it's Gianni Mura Punto, the day that Marco Pantani sadly died. We're going to near Pantani's birthplace today, so I thought I'd read it out again. So Gianni Mura said, he'll probably become a myth like they always do when they die young or when we don't understand why they've gone. I would rather have watched him grow old and gone for a glass of Sangiovese with him somewhere up there in his hills.
Yes, nice. Well, nice words you will enjoy it, Lionel. Spoiler alert, you will enjoy it.
and Rich, as I was going to explain, they this is what's known as a super Tuscan. Super Tuscans were sort of invented in the 70s when a group of like of high profile winemakers in Tuscany, they were a bit frustrated by the very rigorous regulations for wines like Chianti, famous wines that which dictated how much of a certain grape variety could go in those particular wines, and they went rogue, a bit like the sort of gravel revolution in cycling the last couple of years. They sort of went off piste and went off label, and they decided to make these wines that didn't really pay heed to any particular regulation. And they called them the Super Tuscans, and they're generally very expensive and very sought.
I was going to say it's the punchiest wine, I think, price wise, in our Giro collection put together by Divine Cellars in London, and you can get a case of our Giro wine, can't you, from Divine Cellars. The details in the episode notes, and Greg from Divine is giving a proportion of all sales to the cycling school in Cheney, which we're raising money for through the sale of Stacey Snyder's mugs. A second batch, incidentally, will be available soon. We'll give you details on that very soon, but we're going from one Super Tuscan to another, aren't we?
Max Chiandri, someone who's figured in all of our lives covering cycling for the last 20 years or so, hasn't he? He's an ever-present figure, really.
So, well, my dad, chef, he went to the UK when he was young, like 16 or 17. So I'm talking about mid-50s. He went over to the UK to work in London as a chef, and then eventually met my mom, and that's why then they got married, and all three of us, I got a brother and a sister, both of them younger, and we were all three born in Derby at the time. My mom was British, her parents were British, and so we were all three of us born in England. Then we moved down to Bournemouth, and then when I was around 10 years old, so around 77, we moved back to Italy. Well, we moved to Italy. It was my first time, obviously.
Do you remember much about Derby or Bournemouth? I mean, I can remember.
I can remember Bournemouth. I went to school there. I went to school in Bournemouth because when I was seven, I moved. So I went to school there, and I remember that. I remember that side of it. I remember the ice cream van coming along when the little street we used to live in, and stuff like that. You know, I got some vague memories of when I was a kid in the UK. But you know, the majority of it is obviously Italy, because you know, then 10, 12, then you start to remember a little bit more of your small, your infant side of it, you know, kid side of it.
So were you brought up in a household that spoke both English and Italian, and you learned both as a kid?
Yeah. So I didn't know much of Italian, but yeah, Italian was a bit, you know, it was spoken in the house. My dad used to speak quite a bit of Italian to us, but it's pretty funny, because when we came to Italy, and they put us right into school, so I just remember I sat in school, didn't know a word of Italian, or just like a few little things here and there, and I got through school without, you know, it took me quite a while to learn the language. But I kind of learned it the hard way, just like put it to school every day and just quiet all morning, and kind of that was it, you know. So it was a pretty brutal transition from England to Italy in that way, you know.
So when you moved to Italy, was that to Tuscany, and was that your first visit to Italy, or had you been on holidays?
That was my first time in Italy. My first time in Italy. So we moved. It was funny, because we moved down where Tirreno starts, where the last like 4 or 5 years Tirreno started with a team time trial. We moved right in that area on the coastline, and that's where I lived for like another 10 years in Italy, in that area.
Which town is that?
Lido di Camaiore.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Viareggio, Lido di Camaiore. That's where Tirreno starts every year. I mean, for the last at least 4 or 5 years.
And what did you make of that, going from Bournemouth by the sea to Lido di Camaiore by the sea?
No, it was pretty strange, obviously. It was a massive transition, you know. At the beginning, as I said, I didn't know the language at all, and that was a big barrier. But then you just, you know, you kind of make friends, and you know people, and you know kids, and you just pick it up pretty quickly, you know. So it was just me and my brother, my sister. She's 6 years younger than me, so she was quite small at the time. And so it just me and him, and slowly kind of made ourselves, you know, Italian in a way.
And just on your dad as well, because he ended up in Los Angeles, I seem to remember. Have I got that right? Or
you got it right, yeah. They're still there now, yeah.
So he went there to run restaurants?
So, yeah, then we came to Italy, and basically we stayed in Italy for another 10 years, more or less, something like that, 9 years. And one day in 1985... when I was then cycling with a friend, he decided to go over to LA because he had cousins in America. So he had cousins who were in the wine business, and they are still in the wine business now in San Francisco area. And, you know, they told him, come over, try, you should try. So he just went over one day, him and a friend, and they came back and they said, okay, LA. And in 1985, He brought the whole family to Los Angeles.
Wow.
So that was another transition.
And how long were you over there?
Well, my parents, my mom, dad, my brother, my sister, they're all still in America. They're all American citizens now, and et cetera, et cetera. I stayed there for roughly 3-4 years, something like that, 4 years. I stayed there for 4 years, yeah.
And is your dad still working?
Yeah, my dad's still, he has a few restaurants. They have as a family, him and my brother and my sister, they have 6 restaurants all in LA. They had quite a few restaurants around America. They had them in New York, they had them in Miami, they had them in Vegas, they had them in San Francisco and Los Angeles. They had a lot of restaurants, like a company around. But then, now they're all down in LA. So in Los Angeles.
For some of our listeners who will be in or around Los Angeles, what are the names of the restaurants that they can go and take a visit?
So, yeah, well, actually, the most famous restaurant he had is actually, they closed it literally a few months ago, and it was called Ago. And it was him and Robert De Niro, that's a good friend of him, and they partnered up. They had quite a few restaurants. But they, you know, they have a lifetime, so this one had a lifetime, a span of like 15 years on it, and they decided to close it after 15 years, literally a few months ago. So it was called Ago, and it's a very known restaurant in Los Angeles.
Well, that was the one, Robert De Niro and Ridley Scott, I think, and maybe some other, celebrities, was it?
Yeah, the partner of my dad was him and De Niro. They opened, and De Niro, you know, calls my dad Ago, so I said, let's call it Ago, as in Agostino, as an abbreviation. So that's how they call the name Ago. That's how they call that restaurant Ago. And unfortunately, they closed it. They literally decided to close it a few months ago after 15 years. But they have, my dad has 2 other restaurants called Toscanova. One is in Calabasas and one is in Century City. They have Cafe Roma right in Beverly Hills on, I think, Camden or Beverly Drive. They have another restaurant called Sortino down in Brentwood. And the latest one they open is in downtown. Downtown LA is coming back to its beauty, and it's called Vespaio. It's right next to the Disney Hall, and it's right in the center, the heart of downtown Los Angeles. That was opened a couple of years ago.
Has your dad got like a signature dish now that you would say, if you're ever over in LA and you do drop into one of his restaurants that you like?
No, not really. It's very Tuscan food. So, you know, if people know well Italy, you know, Sicily and the north side of it and whatever, but Tuscan olive oil is one of the main ingredients of everything, I'd say, because that's how we are in Tuscany. But it's a pretty well good menu, and sort of fish and meats and pastas and so on.
Do you the Tuscan dish that I think it's a Tuscan dish, is it the Papa al Pomodoro, the
Papa
bread
pomodoro, yeah,
the
yeah.
bread and tomato yeah. soup. I mean, yeah. I always have that if I can.
That's a very poor dish on the days, you know. So when the days they had a lot of, you know, I wouldn't say during the war, but it's like a dish where you had the bread and you have the leftovers of the bread, and you just, you know, with the water and just make the bread soft and then put the pomodoro in. It's very drop of olive oil, a bit of basil on it, and there you go.
Simple.
Pomodoro.
Simple. So once you got to Italy, I mean, Italy, like England, you know, football mad, but cycling, obviously, probably still the number two sport in Italy, and probably in the 70s when you were arriving there, probably rivaling football as the number one sport. But how did you get into it, especially if your dad wasn't really interested in sports? What exposed you to cycling?
Yeah, so it was it's like when you just asked me that question, the picture of when I really started is so alive in me and so real. Basically, we used to go to school with a bike, me and my brother. We had one bike each, little, like, in Italy they call them Graziella. It's like a small little bike, and the top tube runs down, so it's like more for ladies. So we had these bikes, and we used to go to school. It was literally a couple K, a K and a half. And one day, this guy, this friend of mine, this guy who went in the same class as me, shows up with this race bike. And it was the first time I ever saw a race bike, and I saw the handlebar went down, and I was like, wow, this bike looks amazing, you know? And I was like, so we had this little cavalcavia. Cavalcavia is a bridge what goes over the freeway. That's how they call them in Italy, cavalcavia. So I remember me and him riding to school because he lived near my house, and he had this really slick-looking bike. And going up this cavalcavia, this little, it's nothing, but just imagine when you're 10 years old, this little, you can just feel that little bridge. I used to drop him, you know, literally go away. So I was like, wow. So he's like, you know, and this was it. And he was racing in the local town. And the club was called GS Versilia. So for people who know a little bit Italy, Versilia is all the beach side from Viareggio up to Forte di Mar, Mimassa, Cinquale, all that side. And the team was called GS Versilia. So basically seeing him with his bike every day going to school, and I saw he had this thing to change gears, and I was like, whoa, this is all great. And so what I did, I asked my mom, and she signed me up in the local club, cycling club. And that's how I got into cycling. Nobody, I asked them, and my mom absolutely had no clue what bike was and cycling was. My dad absolutely had no clue. I mean, yeah, Italian, maybe he knew a bit the history of the Italian cyclist in the day, but he wasn't into sports at all. So that's how I got into it.
Can you remember what your first race bike was, what brand it was?
It was a local, because you had in the days, in the 70s, 80s, 60s, you had a lot of bike manufacturers, you know, very small little, and it was called Cicli Baglini, with a B-A, Baglini, and it was around Pisa. And he was the guy who supplied bicycles to GS Versilia, to the team I used to race with. So that was my first bike. And a funny story, just to, it's like talking about a million years ago, you know. So the team, when you show up and you sign up for the team, you get a bag, nice bag, and the clothes, all the clothes they give you, they're all used from the guy from the year before. So you wouldn't get a new pair of chamois, you know, or shorts, or a new jersey, or get a jersey that's been used and maybe has a little hole from a crash stitched up from the year before. So that's, you know, we're talking about many, many years ago. And you know, these small little cycling clubs what struggled all the time, probably. And
if you got a good jersey without a hole in it, you know, that was something to be proud of.
That was a Sunday jersey for the race, you know, because races were on Sunday at the time.
So were you good when you started racing? Was it immediately obvious that you were quite good at cycling?
Yeah, so I was good right away because that's like a pretty shit statement. But I did my first race. I remember Ready, Steady, Go. I still remember it. It's incredible. It's like, boom, right in my head. And I just wanted to ride in the front of the peloton. Just imagine these 30 little kids. And I go on the dirt. I remember start, and I just sit in the front the whole day. Sit in the front, and just riding in the front. And I finished like six or seven. I can't remember. But when you used to show up at a bicycle event, at a bicycle race, usually it was like a bar what used to organize it, you know. So and the bar is usually like the hub of the local bike club, you know. So what you do, you get there with a van, with a car, and all the families get together, they bring all the kids, the sport directors there, and you used to go inside the bar and look at your category and see all the prizes. So let's say G1, G2, G3, depending on your age. And so I used to show up first race and I go in the bar and have a look and I see all the little cups, like little trophies, no? That's all, sorry, cups, trophies, small ones. I'm talking about first, second, third, fourth and fifth. And then, you know, they always give you like prizes in like a mortadella, salamino, a pair of shoes, what they didn't sell in the shop. You know, local people would give in stuff and these will be the prizes for the kids. So basically, to just cut it short, I finished like sixth or seventh. And I went to the, after the whole event, you go and it's the la premiazione, it's when they give all the trophies out. I didn't get a trophy, I got a little medal. So I was so pissed about that. And I just sat in the car and I was like, I'm going to stop cycling. I wanted a cup. I wanted a trophy. I just remember I was so pissed about it. And then we went on to the second Sunday. It was my second race and I got second. And there I got my little trophy and I was all happy. And then I think the third race I won. So it started out pretty good. But the first one, I still remember it, yeah.
And so was it a fairly smooth progression? I mean, you going pretty well, and then suddenly you're uprooted and you're off to Los Angeles. I mean,
no, it started like this. And then I'm riding well, and then suddenly I'm moving into categories, and then I go into the national team. So I'm riding with. It's funny, this story. It's like Dario Bruccardo. He was a big Italian coach in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I think one of the most representative figures in cycling, in the Italian Cycling Federation. So he was the head coach on the track. And in 1985, Italy picked me for the European Championships on the track. And I wear the Italian jersey. And I do a race in up in Vigorelli, you know, the Vigorelli Velodrome, in where Coppi did the hour record, was now dismantled, and I win the scratch race, I win one of the European, because they had like a few tests, you know, like few events, sorry, of European track, and I won one of them. So. And I won this race, and then literally a few weeks after. I'm on the plane. I'm going to LA. So, and it's funny. And I brought all that stuff to Los Angeles. So when I go to see my mum and dad, I got my, because they changed a couple of houses, but the house they live in is been there. They've been living in it since when they almost moved to America. So all my national Italian kit, when I had the Italian license, was still in LA. So. LA gave me basically the chance to see both sides of life, and it gave me, you know, it opened doors in terms of, you know, I started working in the restaurant with my dad, and I just put the bike away and I was like, I'm stopped cycling, that's it, you know. And you know, I'm talking about 86 87, you're 17 years old, living in Los Angeles. It's pretty cool place to be, you know. And I stopped cycling for like 8 or 9 months. And then one day my mum came to Italy and I said, Mum, I want a bike. So she brought me a Fanini bike back to LA. And then I started cycling again. I always had a dream that I wanted to turn pro. So when I went to America, it kind of cut that whole dream I had, you know, and I was like, and I was fascinated by the life in LA and so on. But when I started cycling again in Los Angeles, and that's a good side of it, because one day, I'll give another little story. One day we had they used to have these criteriums all around America, sponsored by American Airlines and Nabisco. It's like Nabisco's like being bought by Nestle, it's like a big cereal company and biscuits and so on and so on. So he used to go around America flying and racing. And they had this criterium in West Hollywood. And I lived in West Hollywood when I went to America. So, boom, West Hollywood criterium. I'm racing literally with a jersey on my own. It's different. In America, you just apply for a license, put a jersey on and you race. And here the whole team of 7-Eleven shows up, and Jim Awkward's is there, Phineas there and all the 7-Eleven team. I'm talking about 87, 80, 88, something like that. So we're doing this, we're starting with Criterium, and we come to the final lap, sprint, and the whole line out is for Davis Finney. And I go and sprint, and I beat Davis Finney, and I win, and he gets second. So I'm talking about this little kid, it's me, and I beat the whole 7-Eleven. And it's a funny story, because that's when I met Jim Ockwitz. So I know Jim Ockwitz from 1987. And, you know, and then I work, we're together again in BMC 25 years after. So it's incredible.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our long-term supporters. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code Daniel. A man who can hold five languages in his head, but not a seven-character discount code.
25SIS. 25SIS.
SISCP25. It's deliberate.
It's deliberate.
SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. 25% off all your Science and Sport products. Science and Sport are getting me around our Giro. I must say, I have been consuming a lot of their stuff. A couple of energy bakes today. Get your Science Sport stuff at sciencesport.com. Now, Lionel, we've reached about the midpoint of the episode.
Not just the midpoint of the episode and the midpoint of our chat with Max Chiandri, but the midpoint of our Giro. This is the middle day of our 23 days of coverage, and this is the middle of the middle day.
You're at the midpoint in your case of wine, Rich?
Probably.
You reached the intergiro of our wine tour a few days ago. Didn't you?
No, I've been pretty disciplined actually recently.
Well, I found after probably 3 or 4 days of our Giro on the RGT platform that I just haven't got the time because of, you know, recording the podcast, researching for the episodes, and mainly because of increased childcare duties. I haven't had the time to ride all of the stages. So I revised my target. Just quite happy.
You don't hear
to reach
that from many riders, do you, at the Giro? You don't hear that a lot. Like, I just didn't have time to finish the stage yesterday. Why didn't you finish? I didn't have time.
Well, to be fair,
I was busy.
To be fair, it is their jobs to ride, and you know, it's not my job to ride our Giro, is it? To be fair, so I've revised downwards to just completing half of each stage. I've been dubbing it the Intergiro. People may not be that familiar with what the Intergiro competition was, but it ran from 1989 through to 2005, and the winner or leader of the competition wore a very fetching blue jersey, the Azzurri jersey. It was first won by a Slovenian, Jure Pavlic, in 1989, succeeding in taking a Giro classification where Primoz Roglic fell short last year. Quite an illustrious list of winners, really. Phil Anderson, Miguel Indurain, Jamaluddin Abdujaparov, Tony Rominger, and this man, Magnus Backsted. But how did the Intergiro competition actually work? Let's hear from Magnus, who still has his blue jersey at home somewhere, about how they totted up the times and awarded the blue jersey for the Intergiro classification.
Well, that is actually quite an interesting one. And I don't think many people have actually managed to get this right yet. And I got to say, when I started racing the race, I didn't even understand it properly. So all of a sudden, I found myself in that jersey. But basically, it's halfway through the stage, there is a finish line, and it works just like the pink jersey would do, where, you know, if you're in the breakaway, you accumulate time. So it's basically trying to, I guess, emphasize and give people who are more of a breakaway specialist, not necessarily a sprinter or a climber or a GC rider as such, an opportunity to get a jersey as well. So halfway through the stage, every day there is a finish line, and first across that line every day obviously gets then a time, and that time is then accumulated over the 21 days of racing. And also there are then into sort of bonus seconds on that line as well. So if it does come down to a punch sprint for the halfway finish, then there are bonus seconds to be had as well. So I don't know if that made anyone any wiser as to what the Intergiro is, but in short, that's how it works. For me, it wasn't really something that I targeted, and it was, I kind of all of a sudden ended up being in breakaways left, right and center, and with that I found myself then being right up there in the mix of for the Intergiro competition. And when we realized that, then we sort of started putting a little bit more of an emphasis on it, and we started to do you know, proper lead outs into the finishes for the Intergiro. And obviously I was already quite used to being in breakaways a lot, and obviously I started looking for more and more opportunities to get into breaks. But as the race went on, obviously the other guys were sort of competing for the Intergiro, then they started putting teams on the front to bring the break back and so on and so on. So it was kind of a very hard fought first half of the bike race. And then it all of a sudden then sort of chilled out a little bit once we got past the halfway stage, and then the GC guys who went for the pink jersey started racing. It was something that was a bit, how should we put it, a bit of a mystery to everyone really, and even to the riders to a large extent, until you sort of were all of a sudden in the mix of it, and you sort of went, okay, I got to work out what's going on here and how I will actually win this. And obviously the time trial stages were exactly the same, so that's where I really ended up sort of cementing the win for the Intergiro competition, was in the two time trials that we had that year. One, I think it was into Bolzano, where I finished second, but I basically went all in to the to get to the halfway point of that time trial, and managed to do so with a significant lead, and that really got me sort of a good sort of gap ahead of the rest of the riders. I'm really quite proud of having won it, and I remember it was a really, really hard year to try and hold on to that to that particular competition. I had Suarada and Zabala chasing me in it, so having to battle with Suarada in the sprints final week was quite difficult.
Now, just lastly on the Azzurra jersey, the blue jersey, it's of course the colour of the national team, isn't it? The football team and the cycling team wear blue. So did people recognise that when you were riding round? Did it resonate with the spectators, or is the Giro just about the pink jersey?
No, I think the Italian cycling fan is already very, very clued up on all of the jerseys and the sport in itself. So anyone who wears a jersey, I think, gets his sort of due recognition by wearing it. And I definitely got a lot more fans by wearing the blue jersey than I would have otherwise. I think for me it was a really cool thing to actually have a jersey to wear in the Giro d'Italia, and it's still hanging proudly on my wall at home.
So we've passed the halfway point in our Giro, so let's return to my conversation with Max Chiandri and pick up the story as he's about to turn professional. Remember, if you want to listen to the whole of this conversation unedited, it'll be available soon for Friends of the Podcast.
So when I turned pro for that team in 1989, I already had contacts with Carrera and Ariostea. They wanted me, but I was very loyal to one guy, and this guy was the sport director of that Dromedari team when I went as a little kid, and it was called Callino Menicagli. And this sport director, we remained friends, you know, and he saw me kind of, you know, disappear, went to America and then came back. So he said, okay, turn pro with me in my team. And it was a small team, and the star was Baroncelli, Giambattista Baroncelli was his last year pro. And I turned pro with this team. Well, it was basically a team that had very, very small budget. Baroncelli was at this end of his career. We never really raced together much. And I remember the team actually by mid-season folded up. In terms of, you know, we had the jerseys, but they stopped paying us, and they didn't have bike parts. And so I'd say three quarters into the season, I signed my contract with Carrera, and they actually raced a few races with a Carrera bike in that team. It's a funny story.
Yeah. Well, Baroncelli, of course, had won the Giro di Lombardia a couple of times. He'd been on the podium at the Giro. He'd got a silver medal at the World Championships. So, and you got your first win in your first year in the Giro di Romagna. Is that right?
Yeah. I won the Romagna, but I was second in Lazio. And the second place was Lazio, was a very, very big thing. I won't say like winning, but Lazio at that time was 260, 270K. Charlie Motte was away with two Russian guys. I think they were Alfa Loom. And these two Russian guys had cramps and they stopped and they pulled out the race, literally, because the whole race was all around Rome. And then we came into Rome and we did a couple laps around the Colosseum. And I didn't know that they pulled out. So we did this, the sprint was a sprint where we did a lot and many times after in the years, but it's a pretty strange sprint because you kind of run on the side, you had the right side to finish and you run on the other side of the road going up, U-turn and then dropping down into the finish on the cobbles. And I remember I went to sprint and as all these Saloni was there and all these guys and I beat them and I got second. But I thought I was like fourth or fifth because I didn't know that there's only Charlie Motte in the front and the other guys stopped. So Carlino Minicali comes to me and he's like, straight to the TV. They want you on TV. Because in the days, you used to go on TV right away on the finish and there's Adriano De Zan. So De Zan just loved me because he said, here he is from America. He was an actor. And he did a lot of movies. And so that was my story for my first 4 or 5 years, bro. And he used to say to everybody on TV, and he did movies, and he's friend of Ursula Andres, and this and that. And here I am on the podium.
So you were Max Chiandri straight out of Hollywood.
Yeah, something like that. But he loved the whole story. The Zan really kept me like up in the air a lot, you know, and he had his own people, what he liked. And I was one of them. He really liked me. So then, basically, second place in Lazio, and then a weekend after, I won the Giro di Romagna. Yeah, and it was a great. Even then, I beat Rosola, Saroni. I remember Buontempi almost like a K to go with, like, and he was in Carrera. I mean, I'm talking about Buontempi, one of the biggest sprinters in the days, and I win that race. And and very sadly, Carlino Menicali died a few months after, and or right away, at the end of the year. And then but then I signed my contract with Carrera, and then kind of, you know, and then you pick up, you're in better teams, and then your career starts.
Well, just to give the listeners some background, I mean, they may be familiar with the Carrera team, but it was one of the biggest teams in Italy at that time, sponsored by a company that made jeans. Stephen Roach had won the Giro and the Tour for Carrera a few years earlier, and you were coming into the team just as Claudio Chiappucci was emerging as a potential.
Exactly. Yeah. Both of us, yeah.
So your first year with Carrera, you rode the Tour de France, and now people might think, quite strange for a young guy to get a start in the Tour quite so early these days. It's not that common, is it? But I guess in those days the Giro was probably number one goal for Carrera, and the Tour was obviously still a huge, you know, the biggest race in the world. But it was strange in those days, wasn't it, for the Italian teams? They were still so focused on the Giro just above and ahead of the Tour.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there wasn't many teams that used to go and do the Tour. I mean, in Italy, you had a great calendar, a lot of races. If you won any race in Italy as a pro in the early 90s or late 80s, you always find a contract for at least 1 or 2 years. They had a massive amount of races in Italy. So a lot of teams were happy enough with that. And only a few teams, we used to go and race the Tour de France, and as you said, Carrera was one of them. So I went first year pro, and Chiappucci was just kind of coming out of his who he was. I went to the Tour de France, and I'm talking about 280k stages. We did a team time trial about 80-90k. I remember there's a feed zone in it, and I was like this little kid of 21 years old in this monster team, and it was a pretty brutal experience. But I just want to open a little story here, and just to so people can understand, when I had the academy, I'm jumping forward a lot of years now, when the academy, the British academy was here in Italy, and we had all these pro, I mean, all these guys kind of wanting to turn pro, as in Stannard, as in G, Fumi was here, you know, all these guys. And so what did we do one year? We put them in a team called Barlow World, what was run by Claudio Corti, and Geraint Thomas went to the Tour de France at like 21 years old. So I pushed him into that team and I pushed him to the Tour, because for me, going back to when I did it, as you just said, in Carrera, was a massive life experience, and it literally changed me the day I went in and the day I came out as a different person, as a different athlete, and as a different human being.
Was that because of what you have to adjust to so quickly, the difficulty of it?
Yeah, just because I think you have to do things now in cycling. You know, sometimes I know it's about programming, and a lot of it is now about programming and really looking at events and targeting stuff. But a Grand Tour is, for me, the most important thing a young rider can do, a neopro can do, because you get to know yourself inside out, and it really tells you my weak spots, where I need to be better, and how I can change and what I need to do, you know. So the sooner you do it, and the better it is. That's what I think.
And I mean, it's that, like that Tour de France was a real baptism of fire for you anyway, because on the Sunday morning of the opening weekend, Chiappucci got into that four-man break with Steve Bauer, Ronan Pensec, yeah, and Franz Masson, and they got 10 minutes on the defending champion Greg LeMond and all the other favourites, and the race really boiled down into a pursuit between LeMond and Chiappucci in the final week, didn't it? So you were in a position where you were working for the yellow jersey for a number of days. I mean, that must have been quite a learning experience on its own.
Yeah, no, it's a massive experience for me in every single way. One, because I was a young kid, and what I missed, and here is another little point, is I missed the amateur racing in Italy, because I came from America. I did 1 year in Italy as an amateur. I got the jersey in the pink in the baby Giro, and it was the year when the Konyshev won it, and Andy Amstein won the pro scenario. So I just had 1 year of amateur. So what I didn't have was experience. I didn't have that experience I needed of maybe 3-4 years of amateur racing, maybe a few stage races as an amateur. And I went straight into the pro world with no background at all. And I had to make experience quickly. So that's what I missed, you know, and I didn't have I didn't have a mentor what was behind me and could say, hey, you need to do this, and this is how we do things. I just, like, the first year with that Baron Kelly team was just like kind of everybody was on their own, and then I'm straight into Carrera and then into the Tour. So I missed all that part, but I had to make up for it and just listen to guys, and one of the guys what guided me the best in that Tour was Massimo Girotto, and he was my mentor and really helped me to get to Paris and give the best for the team, because he was a good guy. As in Guido Bontempi, he was just all about himself. we get on, because now he's on the motorbike in the Giro. He's like, you know, one of them guys in front of the race, and I'm a director or whatever, but we're two ordinary people. But he wasn't that friendly when I was in the team. So, but I found a great guy in Girotto what really helped me to get to Paris and do my job during the race.
And then the following year, you won your first Giro stage, and it was ahead of LeMond, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was funny because, again, here my mentor comes in, and we're riding along the coastline before Savona, and it was up and down. It was pissing with rain, I remember. And he's like, he comes to me, he says, how are you? I said, I'm feeling okay. He said, I feel like shit. He said, hey, if you want to do the race today, look at that guy. And I put my head up, and I look, and I see this guy, and I say, oh, that's Greg. Literally, okay, after, boom, Greg attacks on a little kick-ups. And I go with him, and it's me, him, and a guy called Coppolillo. He never pulled. He never gave one turn. Behind, we have Del Tongo with Cipollini, 1967, just like me. So he's kind of coming out of his shell. You know, he's another guy starting to win. And the whole team of Del Tongo was pulling. So we had like a minute and a half, and it comes slowly, slowly comes down. Then we get to Savona right in the center, and it's like a big road, big, big wide road, slightly uphill finish, and we're just pissing with rain. And I remember Greg starts out the sprint, Coppolillo gets dropped, actually gets caught by the peloton, another K to go, and he puts a couple meters on me. And I'm like, you know, when you get out of your saddle and it's soaking wet and you've got a couple hundred Ks in your legs, and my legs are killing me. And he gets 1 meter, 2 meters, and then I pull him back on his wheel, and then I start pulling out, you know, and I did the, and then I beat him, and that was my first stage. Great day.
Was that, that was a big deal. I mean, beating the Tour de France champion in a Giro stage, even in the rain. I mean, that must have been a great day.
Yeah, fantastic day. You know, and then it's like, you know, I'm here, I'm in the big world, I'm in the real world, and it was, I don't want to say to the people listening, it's like, it's different, but it was different, because in the days he had one winner, one leader in a team, and everybody had to work for him. Now, you know, you set out for, okay, you can go for Paris-Roubaix, obviously you're going to have one leader in each team, but you go out in a lot of races and a lot of people can win, and it's more open. But in the days, you really had to work, you really had to put your head down for the leader, you know, and it was a little bit harder to put your head out and say, here I am. It was a little bit harder in them days than now.
And if you had a good chance to do something and you didn't take it, you might not get another chance for
exactly,
3 months.
Exactly.
It was really enjoyable to hear Max Chandry talk at length and quite expansively about his journey, because we do know him well, Lionel, but we don't often have an opportunity to sit down with him and have that sort of conversation. And as I said earlier on, the whole conversation will be available to friends of the podcast if you want a bit more of Max Chandry. That'll be on the friends feed. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to hear him, and also Richie Port from a couple of days ago. And we do know him these days, I suppose, primarily as a sports director, BMC, and more recently at Movistar. Always very approachable, isn't he? And always very willing and happy to talk. And I guess one of the things listening to him talk about his days as a writer is to be reminded about what a good writer he was. And one story that really pricked my attention was the win, small race maybe, but in West Hollywood, where he took on 7-Eleven, who had been riding Grand Tours. And later in our series, we'll hear from Andy Hampston, who had ridden the Giro d'Italia for 7-Eleven in 1985. And they were starting to get a foothold on European racing, starting to ride well. I mean, Davis Finney, who he beat, you know, was a very, very good sprinter in Tour de France stages and so on. He won a stage of the Tour de France, didn't he, in 87? So they were a very strong team. And for Max, you know, the way he describes it, I kind of imagine him turning up at that race wearing jeans and on a kind of fixie and taking them on and winning, a kind of hipster Max Chandry in Hollywood. But that story and others did sort of just reinforce or remind me what a good rider he was back in the day.
I think one of the interesting things about Max as well, Rich, is that, and I wasn't aware of this until I listened to the interview, was just how much time he had spent in the States and in his youth, and how much he was kind of viewed as a bit of an oddity, as something quite exotic or someone quite exotic when he then came back to Italy. Because, you know, the picture he paints of Tuscany and Tuscan cycling and Italian cycling in those years when he was growing up and when he was in Italy is this kind of honeyed sort of Instagram sepia toned vision of Italian cycling that's been lost, really, you know, competing for a mortadella and a cup, and, you know, every village had its own frame maker. And, you know, even when I lived in Italy for a short period in the late 90s, that was the case. You know, when you went out with guys cycling, everyone would have a frame made by a different artisan. And you know, that over the course of the next sort of 20, 30 years was lost, has been lost to a certain extent. And I found myself getting quite sort of wistful about that when Max was talking about the time he spent in Tuscany and sort of becoming a cyclist.
It's made him a very interesting guy for us as well, because you sense, again, it came through there. You mentioned his Tuscan identity and that he is a kind of super Tuscan, but he also, there's a sense of him not really perhaps feeling a full sense of belonging himself in Italy. You know, he didn't grow up there in his early years. So to us, he's very Italian. To the Italians, he might be, you know, kind of Anglo-Italian, and yet he's got this kind of American streak running through him as well. So he's kind of very multinational.
And of course, he's still been spending a lot of time in Hollywood and you know, acting in films under the nom de plume Matthew McConaughey for years. And no one's really picked up on that.
I mean, combining that with Movistar DS, well, I guess that's possibly possible, isn't it? I mean, doable, manageable.
And rather overlooked by the Italians, especially when it came to the World Championships. I mean, I'm just looking back at the sort of purple period of his career from sort of 93 through to 95, when he was winning, you know, the Giro stages. He won a stage of the Tour in 95, famously lost to Bjarne Riis in a sprint in the 1993 Tour. And on the Channel 4 coverage, the interview after the finish line was him basically just incredulous that he'd lost a sprint to Bjarne Riis. But that year, 93, third in Milan-San Remo, third in the Tour of Lombardy, third in the overall World Cup, and yet he wasn't really, he was more of an outsider when it came to the Italian World Championship team, and that's what led him to take up a British racing license in time for the Olympic Games in 1996, and we'll hear about that in tomorrow's episode, and also about the 2000 edition of the Giro d'Italia when he was riding for the Linda McCartney team. I mean, this is a whole can of worms in itself, isn't it, the boom and bust of the Linda McCartney team. But they did get to the Giro in the year 2000, the first British-backed and British-run team to ride a Grand Tour since the ANC Halfords team had done the Tour de France in 1987. And I mean, we take for granted now, don't we, Team Sky, Team Ineos and all of the British success. But at the time, Linda McCartney getting on the start line at the Giro was quite a big deal, and Max was very much the figurehead of that team. Well, he almost won a stage the day after his teammate David McKenzie did win a stage, and we'll hear a bit more about that tomorrow.
You mentioned him losing a sprint to Bjarne Riis, and you know, I remember when I first started watching cycling, and in fact the first race I ever saw live was the Leeds Classic in 1996, and Max lost a sprint there that I think most people thought he should have won to his countryman, the Italian Andrea Ferrigato. And it seemed to me that for a number of years around about that time, people did sort of view him as a bit of a choker, is a very harsh word, but someone who didn't take opportunities when they were presented to him. I mean, was that fair?
He had a fast finish, but he was a guy. I mean, we're on transition stage today in our Giro, and that's sort of appropriate too, because he was a man for the transition stages to get into a break. And my memory is of him often losing those from those positions where you know on paper it looked like he had a very good chance of winning. Yeah, and that's why listening to him and listening to some of his successes and listening also to Lionel's list there of some of his placings as well does remind you that he was a good rider.
Well, we'll hear a little bit tomorrow about how when he did get an opportunity in the Olympic Games, he came away with a medal, not for Italy but for Great Britain. But that will come tomorrow.
I enjoyed that story very much indeed. Lots to look forward to tomorrow in our Giro. That's all for tonight. We're going to play out with Francois Tomaso, aren't we, and his little tribute to the spectacular red wine that we've enjoyed during this episode, you and me, Daniel, anyway. Lionel, you've got that to look forward to. Until tomorrow, chaps.
Is this a song by UB40? Red wine, is it?
Yeah, is it, but it's not originally a UB40.
Was it
song,
originally UB40?
Well, originally, Daniel, of course, it was a Neil Diamond song, but the most famous version of it, arguably, is UB40's version.
Until now.
Till now, yeah. I very much enjoyed Francois' version, so hope you do too. That's all for now. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Red, red one goes to my head, makes me forget that I still need a sun. Red, red one, it's up to you. All I can do, I've done. Memories won't go. Memories won't go. I'd have sworn that we've done. Thoughts of you would leave my head. I was wrong, now I've found just one thing makes me forget. Red, red wine, stay close to me. Don't let me be alone, it's tearing apart my blue heart. I'd have sworn that with time thoughts of you would leave my head. I was wrong, now I've found just one thing makes me forget. Red, red wine, stay close to me. Don't let me be alone, it's tearing apart my blue heart.
Oh, well, got a little song by Neil Diamond in this, in the UB40 version. Well, just to remind you first that, you know, too much red wine can be dangerous, but you know, just as much red wine as you need is great. And well, during our Giro, as you know, you have a chance to discover lots of great Italian wines. To be honest, you know, being French, I find them sometimes excellent, but much too expensive for what they are. But anyways, no, Italians have got beautiful wine, of course, and well, as far as I know, well, there'll be lots of advice and a wine list for the Giro in our Giro, and I'll tell you what, I'm going to discover lots of them and try them as well, and once again without overdoing it. Well, that was François Tomaso with my little song for our Giro, and you know, well, see you soon, and keep well.